Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Michael Kwas, the author of Contraband, Louis Mondrain and the Making of a Global Underground. And the book was published by Harvard University Press in 2014. Hi there, Michael.
Hi, Roxane. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I wonder if you could get us started by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in working on France.
Well, I guess it goes back a ways. When I was in college, I read a book by Natalie Davis, a collection of essays called Society and Culture of Early Modern France. And I think it was her essays that really drew me into French history and the early modern world more generally. I don't think I'm the only French historian who was drawn into the profession by Natalie Davis's work. I hear this story a lot, but it's clearly what sort of put the early modern period and France in particular on the map for me. And then I got interested in debates about the French Revolution, which is obviously a very dynamic field and a very contested one. And I like the sort of the rigor of the debate. And that sort of put me on a trajectory to graduate school. I went to Michigan, where French history was really very lively in the late 80s and early 90s. There was a lot going on there, and that really worked out well for me, I think.
And what brought you to the subject of this book in particular?
I wrote a first book on fiscality, taxation, and political culture. And so I liked those questions. And then I shifted to studying consumption, the rise of consumption in the 18th century, and the debate on luxury, which was a kind of prominent debate in this period. And that got me into questions of consumption. But I kind of grew a little dissatisfied with my own work and with others in the field working on consumption, because it seemed to move away from political questions. So I wanted to find a way to get back to those political questions that I'd always been dealing with, and yet keep the consumption aspect of my work. And smuggling became a way to do that. And so I thought, that's an excellent way to do both and to bring in the global dimension as well. So once I kind of found my way into smuggling, I didn't look back, and I sort of plunged in.
Well, and I want to ask you about all of those different things that you've just raised. So the book is about Louis Mondrain, this notorious 18th century smuggler, but it's also a book about a much wider context and about this consumer revolution that took place in early modern France. So could you give us a bit of background regarding that revolution, just in broad terms?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first I should say that not everyone is happy with the term consumer revolution.
Right.
And this, you know, there seems to be so many revolutions these days, they're hard to keep track of. And I think that some people suggest that, you know, revolution's a too strong a term, but I'll talk about that in a second. But I'll use the term just for the sake of, you know, teaching this moment here of the 18th century. But basically, there's clearly a growth of consumption in the 18th century. And first, historians of England took notice of this, notably John Brewer, but many others. And it became clear that it was not constricted to 18th century England, but there was a growth of consumption in 18th century France, in the Netherlands, Northwestern Europe in general, and beyond. And so the kind of original understanding of the consumer revolution expanded geographically. And in France, you know, we had wonderful professors like Daniel Roche writing about the growth of consumption in this period. And usually when they talk about consumption in this period, they're talking about the growth of clothing. I mean, there's always been clothing, of course, but people's wardrobes broaden, they become denser, that people have more articles of clothing, home furnishings, so that people's homes seem to be filling up with stuff. And this can be sort of decorative stuff. This can be kitchenware, tables, chairs, all kinds of furniture. And then also there's an obvious growth in colonial products. Mm-hmm. These are things like sugar and tobacco and tea and coffee and chocolate, things that, by the way, and we could talk about this later, they're produced in a slave system, a slave economy across the Atlantic and elsewhere. So there seemed to be, and this is odd, before the Industrial Revolution, there seemed to be a growth in consumption. Most people assume that any sort of major growth in consumption would occur after the Industrial Revolution, when you have the factories kind of cranking out goods. But it seems that before the introduction of factories in Europe, in Western Europe at least, there was a kind of a serious amount of growth in certain kinds of consumption. And so people are really looking at that, and people have called it a consumer revolution, though some people suggest that revolution, as I said, is too strong a term because, you know, it took a long time for this to happen. And there are questions about the social depth of this so-called revolution. That is, you know, who really is consuming more? There's still a whole lot of people, working people, who are not consuming more in this period. And you don't want to make it sound like everyone is doing just beautifully and consuming more when that's really not happening.
So, Michael, contraband looks at smuggling and illicit trade, and you make the point that the violence of consumption and of this consumer revolution, longer process, whatever we want to call it, particularly within the metropole of this colonial system, is often left out of the story of this early modern period of transformation. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It struck me as I was reading all this work, including my own work, that we were sort of depicting an 18th century that was a little too happy, a little too rosy. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, people are consuming goods and retailers are describing goods in new ways. And there seems to be new values like privacy and comfort and pleasure that are coming. It just seemed a little bit too idyllic. And so what I wanted to get at was to get at the underbelly of this world and to suggest that there's a kind of dark side to the rise of consumption and to the globalization, the global trade that sustained that consumption. And so smuggling and the violence associated with the underground economy, to me, was a great way into that question.
I want to kind of take I don't know if it's a detour, but ask a sort of methodological question, just the kind of nuts and bolts of this, because you make the point in the introduction, I think, that some of this has to do with, some of this emphasis on a happier enlightenment has to do with the sources that historians have looked at. And you make a point about, you know, using probate documents and that kind of thing. And I'm wondering if you could just say a little bit more about the sources that you use in this book to get at this underbelly, as you call it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the sources that most people use for consumption are probate inventories, which list how much stuff someone has at the time of his or her death. So it gives you a kind of frozen picture of the goods someone has. It doesn't really tell you where those goods came from, how they got there, what kind of tensions surrounded their circulation and things like that. So the other source people tend to use are kind of advertisements. You know, what are people saying about all these new wonderful goods? And of course, advertisements are very positive, and they're going to kind of give the impression that these are very positive, emancipatory goods. That is, that this consumption is very positive and emancipatory. So I was trying to find a different set of sources that would take me into the underground economy and reveal the violence. And I have quite varied sources, but the kind of main chunk of those sources were the administrative correspondence surrounding smuggling in the provinces. I used judicial sources, trials of smugglers. And then I also looked at popular print media. So I looked at the way smugglers are depicted. And then I go all the way to, you know, sort of your learned literature of the Enlightenment to see how smuggling was represented among the learned elites.
Throughout the book, Michael, you make this important point that France during this period must be understood in a more global perspective, and that includes thinking about how, France participated in a larger kind of global colonial set of networks and a system, but also how that affected the impact that had domestically. So I wanted to ask you to say a little bit more about that. You're turning to this sort of more global perspective and what that represents for you.
I think French historians, certainly of the early modern period, but arguably of the late modern period too, I think we're a little bit slow to look beyond France at the wider world. I certainly was in my training and in with respect to my first book. And so I wanted to see what France's place in the world was and how that affected the growth of consumption. Look at French Empire, the regulatory controls of overseas goods, taxation of overseas goods coming in. All these things were ways of getting at France in the wider world. For me, it was not something that happened sort of artificially. I was looking at the underground economy and following the goods. And when I realized I needed to follow the goods wherever they led, to their source, places where they were produced and the rest of it, I realized, well, I really need to get way out of France for some of this project. Mm-hmm. I need to follow these goods back to Asia, to the Americas, to Africa. And for me, that was a really exciting part of the book because I had to learn so much to master that material. That was something that I really had to bone up on, and I did. And I think it made the book a lot more interesting to write.
So we've talked now about this sort of global turn, if we want to call it that. I guess I just called it that. what about this term globalization? I think a lot of people associate that term with sort of more contemporary economic issues and transformations and questions. So why use that term to talk about the 18th century? How is that term working for you in the book?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Globalization is a tricky term because so many people use it in daily life today. I'm not really crazy about the way regular people, non-academics, use the term. It seems to imply, and academics too for that matter, it seems to imply a kind of very smooth process whereby, the nation state declines, and goods flow from near to far, communications zip across borders, money goes across borders. And there's a sense that this is somehow, as I said, a very smooth process that's not necessarily problematic. But I think, when certainly studying the early modern period, this process was anything but smooth. So I wanted to keep the term globalization to refer to the integration of world markets, which I think does take place in the early modern period as well mm-hmm. as the modern period. But I wanted to make sure that the globalization I was talking about was not too smooth and that could incorporate questions of contestation and conflict that were inherent in the process of globalization. So I want to keep the word, but sort of adjust its meaning a little bit to account for a more complicated process. Because if you look at the early period, what I call early modern globalization, globalization really in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, it was anything but smooth. you had very powerful states competing for power in far-flung colonies. Even though trade linkages were developing and a kind of global economy was forming, it was always very much contested, conflict-ridden, and a lot of war occurred over these economic questions. There's sort of economic war that was waged for political reasons, political war for economic reasons. And it was that rough and tumble world that I wanted to capture. And I think one can capture it through smuggling.
So, Michael, the book starts it starts in the 17th century and then runs right up to a discussion of the French Revolution. And then you talk about sort of more contemporary issues and legacies and things like that. But what about this periodization? Why does the book begin and end when it does?
Yeah, well, I was looking at the underground. If you look at the underground economy in this period, there's just about everything that is exchanged in there. There's so many hundreds of products are being exchanged illegally. But, you know, if you notice, if you look at closely, there's a particular evolution, and it seems like the underground economy globalizes, it incorporates global commodities in a market way in the late 17th century. And that kind of continues up to the revolution. And that's because of Louis XIV. Louis XIV made two major interventions in the global economy that stimulated the growth of the underground economy. One was the prohibition on calico. Calico was an Indian produced textile that the French East India Company and other East India companies in Europe brought into Europe. Mm-hmm. It became a very popular commodity, almost too popular for its own good, because traditional textile producers began to lobby against the introduction of this good. And so Louis XIV responded to that by declaring a prohibition on calico, and other rulers in other parts of Europe did the same thing. The other intervention that Louis XIV made was to create a tobacco monopoly. Tobacco came from the New World, and the idea was that the crown could make a lot of money by monopolizing this trade, importing tobacco from the New World, and then selling that tobacco to royal subjects throughout France at very high prices. And so these two interventions, and there are other ones, but these are two I concentrate on, in most part because these are the goods that Mondrian will smuggle. These two interventions end up, I think, widening the underground economy to include things like tobacco and calico and a number of other goods. And so that's why I start at under Louis XIV in the late 17th century.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. It's really important to sort of lay the groundwork for the rest of our conversation. You have this great moment in the introduction where you say, I'm quoting here, the criminality and violence associated with illicit markets posed a serious challenge to states whose very policies produced them. So I wanted to just ask you to say a little bit more about that dynamic. And also, before we get to talking about Mondrian, to ask you about the very ominous sounding and ominous in other ways, General Farm, and to just set that up, what was the General Farm and what role does it play in the book?
Yeah, I think that's important to realize that, you know, states always intervene in economies. I mean, mm-hmm. This is a fiction to think that states never intervene or that there's a possibility that they can't intervene, despite kind of neoliberal hopes. States do intervene in economies for all kinds of reasons. Sometimes they're good reasons, sometimes they're not. But when they do intervene, they create opportunities for fraud, illicit trade, smuggling, and things like that. So in the late 17th century, when we had this broader push by the monarchy into the global economy, it's no surprise that there's this underground that forms around those interventions. I hope that's clear. Mm-hmm. And one way that the crown could police these interventions, to institute these interventions, was to rely on this gigantic company called the General Farm. Farm refers to a tax farm. This was a period in Europe when a lot of rulers didn't raise their own taxes. Especially their own indirect taxes, taxes on goods and things like that. And instead, they would farm out their taxes. The French kings did. And they ultimately relied on this one large farm called the General Farm. And it was the General Farm that took the tobacco monopoly in hand, that managed the tobacco monopoly. And it also policed the calico prohibition. So the General Farm was very much at the center of policing these interventions in the economy. It was an enormous organization. By the late 18th century, it consisted of about 30,000 employees, 20,000 of whom were armed guards. So it's a kind of paramilitary organization. And it also had these financiers, the Fermiers Généraux, at the very top of the farm. And these financiers were very wealthy and loaned enormous sums of money to the kings of France. And that gave them, obviously, a lot of credit at court, literally and figuratively, to use Claire Croston's terminology. Mm-hmm. And these financiers, because they lent such huge sums to the crown, were able to get very favorable deals on farming taxes, on handling taxes, on handling the calico prohibition. It was really the farm that created an immense amount of tension in society, because one had this enormous private financial company operating whole parts of the state. And that generated a lot of hostility from consumers and taxpayers and others in French society at the time. The General Farm is really quite a striking institution. I always knew about it. I mean, I've worked on fiscality for years and years and years. But actually delving into it in this way, looking at the provincial records of it, one can see just how large and strong and overwhelming it was. It had weaknesses and vulnerabilities, of course, and there was a lot of fraud and illiteracy among the employees. But still, it's a quite an impressive organization. And I don't think we can really understand what's going on in French politics, French society, French economy in this period without an understanding of the farm.
Okay, let's talk about the star of the show here then, Louis Mondrain. So who was he? I mean, I know that's an incredibly complicated question to answer. And how does his individual story that you track, you know, with such richness, illuminate the broader arguments that you're interested in making in the book?
Yeah, well, Louis Mondrain is an interesting character. And when I found him, when I was sort of reading up on smuggling, discovered Mondrain, looked at what I had already been written about him, I realized I could sort of bend my book around this narrative. So that the book is kind of a microhistory in a sense, but mm-hmm. it's also a kind of global and national history. I didn't want to overly privilege one viewpoint, but kind of running through the whole book is this story of Mondrain, because he is such an intriguing character. He was born in 1725 in southeastern France in a small town called Saint-Étienne de Saint-Jeoire, which is in the province of Dauphiné. If you know it at all, maybe you know Grenoble, which is the capital of Dauphiné in the southeast. This is not too far from the border, which is, partially explains what happened, not too far from the border with Savoie and Switzerland. So he grew up in this family. It wasn't a poor family. It was not a rich family. It was sort of a family of solid, small-town merchants. Louis Mondrain's father died when Louis was still pretty young, about 17. And so Louis Mondrain was kind of thrust into the position of head of household. And this was a kind of tough position for him to pursue. He tried his best, did pretty well, but he went on this kind of financial venture of provisioning the troops, the French troops outside Nice, and this is during the War of Austrian Succession. So he gets a kind of government contract, in a sense. He is a local merchant, after all, to load up all these mules and walk them down to around Nice, to the mountains behind Nice, and distribute food and other provisions for the troops. It's a pretty good idea. A lot of great financiers began this way. But it turns out to be a disaster. The war ends in the middle of the project, which means no one's really going to pay him for any of his stuff. And on his return, a lot of the mules died, and the mules were obviously a major part of his capital expense going into the whole project. And he comes back home, after this calamitous venture, and slowly drifts into a life of crime and into smuggling. It's very hard to uncover this. The sources are limited, but we could kind of see him and his brothers. He had a few brothers, kind of descending into a life of crime, whether that's sort of counterfeiting or petty theft. But for Louis Mondrain, where he kind of ended up settling is with smuggling. And so from his little town, he sort of followed the chain of goods, the flow of goods upstream towards across the border to Savoie, which is now part of France, but then It was not part of France. It was part of the Kingdom of Piedmont, Sardinia. And he crosses the border, and there are a lot of smugglers there. It's kind of known as a smuggling haven. And he gets a start in smuggling, joins a band of smugglers, and eventually heads a band of smugglers, and then engages in some very extensive smuggling expeditions into France. He starts off small, of course, but it gets big right away. And this is in the years 1754 and 1755. Those were the years really doing most of his smuggling. And these were very large campaigns. I mean, they could last 3 weeks, 4 weeks. They could be involved. They could involve scores of fellow smugglers. At one point, his band is over 100 strong. These people are armed. They're on horseback. It's basically what he becomes is he kind of creates a private army of smugglers. This is very lucrative. But there's a sense that he's improvising the whole time, commercially, but also I would suggest politically. And that's sort of where I think his story gets interesting, is that he's not quite a typical smuggler, in that he's not kind of hiding the shadows. He develops ways to smuggle in a very brash, confrontational sort of way that has distinct political overtones. And so that's where the sort of politics of smuggling come in through his example.
Well, and he becomes this sort of mythological figure, right? And I guess, you know, you say this thing about his, you just talked about the politics, but you also talk about the sort of notion of a political theater that Mondrian embodies and enacts.
Yeah, well, what he does, this is what gets people's attention. And of course, he's still a major figure today. A movie just came out about him a few years ago. You know, he's still a popular folk hero in France today. And that was that interesting as well. But if you go back to the origins of what got people's attention, for example, the attention of newspapers at the time, before an explosion of literature after he's executed, which I can talk about. But in this earlier, you know, while he's smuggling, what gets people's attention are these two major innovations that he attempts during his smuggling expeditions. So the first thing he does, and this is sort of what I just sort of was getting at but didn't develop very well, is that instead of hiding in the shadows and staying away from agents of the farm who are constantly policing the markets, he decides to smuggle openly, so that instead of, like I said, hiding in the shadows and, you know, hey, come here, do you want some tobacco? You know, and there are plenty of records of smugglers who do that sort of thing, you know, tap someone on the shoulder at a market and say, hey, come with me to my apartment. I have some really good tobacco. Instead of doing that, he and his men basically ride into town and take over the public square in these small towns, and sometimes not so small towns, and they secure the town and open their own public market in which they sell tobacco, but also calico, especially early on. They were selling both directly to consumers, even though this is entirely illegal. And this shocked people and impressed people. Obviously, the people of the towns were a little bit scared of them. These are well-armed men, and they're rough. Many of them aren't well-educated. Many of them served as soldiers or are fugitives. They know how to handle a gun. That was obvious to the consumers. But the consumers are also very much drawn to the goods, and they flock to these public markets. And this gave, obviously, Mondrian quite a bit of publicity, negative and positive publicity. Obviously, the farm agents were alarmed at this, and you know, back in at Versailles, ministers of state are scrambling to figure out what to do with him. But on the ground, the consumers really liked it. And the other major innovation, and this one is, I think, is even more stunning. To me, it was more stunning. Was that eventually he says, "Okay, enough of these public markets. What I'm going to do is market my illegal contraband tobacco directly to the farm that is running the royal tobacco monopoly." So what he's saying is, I mean, this is like, is if you live in a state that has state liquor stores, for example, this would be like going into a state liquor store with 100 men armed and forcing the liquor store retailers to buy all your your alcohol that was, you know, brewed illegally in your basement or something. So what he does is he takes Mondrian, he holds these farm retailers and warehouses at gunpoint and says, I'm going to offer you a deal that you can't refuse. and they accept the deal. And basically, he unloads a lot of his cargo, a lot of the tobacco, and then the farm agent accepts it because he doesn't have a choice and pays him what he can. Sometimes these farm agents didn't have a lot of cash on hand, so Mondrian would make them go about and ask neighbors and notables in town to help cover the expenses and gather up the money, and they would pay Mondrian and his gang the money. And then at some point, Mondrian actually would write them a receipt for the transaction as if this were a normal free exchange. So that Mondrian would write a receipt. Sometimes he had notaries write receipts for him. And the receipts were there, I argue, and I think I have pretty good evidence for this, to make sure that if the low-level farm agents could kind of pass the receipt up the chain of command at the farm, so that ultimately the farmers general would have to incur the costs of the forced sale. So what we have here is a very strange kind of exchange, economic exchange. It's an exchange that is coercive, mm-hmm. And yet it's also an exchange that pretends not to be coercive in some sense. Mondrian did not want to be seen as a thief, as a criminal in that sense. He even says at one point, you know, my men are not thieves. And yet it's a coercive exchange nonetheless. And this is where I make an analogy between this kind of exchange and what at the time were called taxation populaire, which are kind of food riots, mm-hmm. where consumers of food kind of forced retailers and traders of food, especially grain, to lower their price in times of dearth when prices are very high. These aren't the exact same things, and I want to overdraw the comparison, but they're similar in the sense that the activists in both case are basically forcing an exchange, coercing an exchange, but distinguishing themselves from an illegitimate, from the kind of exchange an illegitimate thief would extort.
I want to ask you some more about that, but before we do, maybe just to sort of close off his story in some sense, that the book charts his rise and his fall. So what happens to him? Give us the...
Yeah,
don't
right.
Leave no. us hanging.
Well, you know, as he's, you know, marauding through the countryside after, you know, several months of this, you know, the ministers of state are desperate to put him down, to stop this from occurring anymore. And so they enlist basically any sort of state agency, policing agency that can be enlisted. So towns are expected to have militias. There's the Marie-Chaussée, which is the kind of rural constabulary, is brought into it. The farm has its enormous police force, which attempts to stop him. None of these institutions can really do it. They're not designed to take down huge gangs, armed gangs. And so eventually the monarchy has to bring in the army. Louis XV and his war minister, D'Argenson, bring in the army. Mm-hmm. And they bring the army first to capture him. And they do this illegally. A huge battalion sneaks across the river into Savoie, foreign territory, illegally at night, and kidnap Mondrian. He happens to be in the chateau belonging to a magistrate from the Parlement of Grenoble. So he had very high connections. This was kind of one of the interesting things. At any rate, they pluck him from the chateau, excuse me, and bring him back to France and put him on trial at a special commission. And I can talk a little bit about that. There's been a revamping of the criminal justice system in this period to deal with smuggling and mm-hmm. smugglers like Mondrian. And they put him on trial. They find him guilty and they execute him. I'm not giving too much away here since one of my chapters is entitled The Execution of they execute him, and it's really after his execution that he really becomes a legend. There's an absolute explosion of popular literature and songs and engravings after he is executed. That's there's some material on Mondrian, some printed material on Mondrian before he's executed, but that's really when you get an enormous burst of literature on Mondrian. And so at that point, after his execution, he lives on in the memory in a very political way, and it's a contested way as well. I mean, this is what he means is different for different people. What his story suggests, what his tale tells, and so there's a sort of a competition over what to make of his legend. Some people demonize him, others heroize him. Some people have very mixed feelings about him, and that's all part of this huge literature that surfaces after his execution.
I want to come back to something you said. Well, really, I think one of the most interesting ideas in the book for me is the way that this underground, this dark side of Enlightenment and the consumer revolution transformation, that it's not that the underside or the underbelly is, in binary opposition to the above ground, but that these things are mutually constitutive in this period. And you just raised this question of, how smuggling and its violence leads to reform. And earlier you said something about, how the state actually produces some of the things that it's trying to control and regulate. So some of the illicit activity. So how did smuggling and its violence provoke reform in the judicial system or the economic system in France?
Yeah. I'm glad you asked. There's a sort of feedback system that develops in this period, so that as the farm is doing its policing and trying to roll back the underground, smugglers respond by forming into gangs, just like Mondrian, but he's not the only gang out there. There are many of them. And as the gangs form and get bigger, then the farm responds to that by adding employees, and coming up with new modes of policing. They're experimenting with, arrest notices, these signalements, which give descriptions of people, of noted criminals. So there's a kind of feedback system between the underground and the policing mechanisms of the absolute state. Now what happens is that also occurs within the criminal justice system. So yes, there's an expansion of policing within the farm and beyond the farm in many ways, but there's also a change in the judicial system that is meant to roll back the underground through a kind of deeper judicial repression. And how that happens is quite interesting. First, the crown issues edicts hardening the penal code against smuggling. And so you get tougher and tougher sentences for smugglers. For example, if you're caught in a gang, an armed gang especially, you can be executed, right? You can be sentenced to death. Or you could be sent to the galleys, which is not a pretty fate. Or if you were just, even if you're just caught selling illegal tobacco, that is non-farm royal tobacco, you can be fined these exorbitant fines. There was a 1,000 livres fine for someone who is simply dealing in contraband tobacco. Now, 1,000 livres is an enormous sum. It's about, 3 or 4 times the salary of an ordinary worker in a town or in the countryside. So that most people couldn't afford to pay it. And if you couldn't afford to pay that 1,000 livres fine, then you would automatically be thrown into the galère, into the galleys. So this was a huge ratcheting up of the criminal justice system. By the time all the laws are created and these new courts are put into place, and I'll talk about the courts in a second, smuggling becomes the single most prosecuted crime in 18th century France. That's something I didn't realize until I was doing this project. So this was very interesting to me because it showed me that there are connections between the global trade and state formation and the underground and the actual judicial system of France. Everything got caught up in this. Obviously, there are contemporary echoes of this, and I'd be happy to talk about later. And so the last change to the judicial system, in addition to hardening the penal code, was to create a new system of courts, because the old courts usually didn't, a lot of magistrates were reluctant to impose such heavy sentences on smugglers because they didn't think smuggling was such a bad crime. There's a kind of normative challenge here for the government to stigmatize smugglers, to punish smugglers in an environment in which people didn't really think smuggling was all that bad. It seemed to be a crime that didn't hurt anyone. It just sort of maybe took a little money from the state. So what? And so there's a problem with prosecuting this sort of crime. So what the government does, what the Crown does, is create new kinds of law courts. First, they create courts on which the provincial intendants sit. And provincial intendants are commissaires. They're kind of royal officials that can be revoked and therefore have to respond to the king and the royal council. And the intendants then prosecute these trials. That works a little bit better than the old judicial system. But there are even limits for what the intendants can do. And therefore, it's the intendant of Dauphiné, intendant named Fontaineu, who becomes very frustrated trying to prosecute violent smugglers in his province. And he asks the Controller General, Henri, to create a new kind of super commission, a new kind of super court that will judge all cases involving smuggling gangs and violence. And this is how the Commission de Valence, Commission of Valence, is created in 1733. And other commissions are created elsewhere in France after Valence. There's a commission in Reims in the northeast, in Caen and in Paris, and there's a kind of small commission in Franche-Comté. So that there's a new layer of courts that are that is added on to the other layers, and it's designed to really go after the big smugglers. And like I said, the effect of this is quite extraordinary. These courts are pretty effective. And many, many people are executed, but many, many more in the tens of thousands are sent to the galleys. And so there's a whole chain of events that leads to a radical revamping of the criminal justice system under the old regime, only because of this underground economy and the attempt to repress it. So there's a lot going on. It's not just this isn't just an economic problem, even just a political problem or a fiscal problem, it becomes a judicial problem as well.
So, Michael, how do we connect the story of Mondrian and smuggling and this underground in economic, political, and then, all the sort of cultural representations and ramifications of this to that intense field of debate and questions about, I mean, I have to ask you about this, about the origins of the French Revolution and the course of the French Revolution. How do we get from your story and analysis in the book to thinking differently about the French Revolution if we do?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent and a very difficult question. I should be careful here because the smuggling, it does not cause the French Revolution. The French Revolution is a very complicated event. We know a lot about it now after years and decades, centuries of debate. So what I try to do is to show how this question of smuggling feeds into the revolution. And I think it does feed into it in a couple of ways. One way is through what I've been talking about in terms of rebellion. That is, there's a history of rebellion, of popular revolt that has been rewritten in a sense by historians like Jean Nicolas. Jean Nicolas is a French historian who works on sort of popular consciousness and revolt under the old regime. And he revised the historiography, and I'll just give you the background quickly because it's fairly important. I think before Nicolas, there was a general assumption that, you know, one of the amazing things Louis XIV did with the, his so-called absolute state was to, stop or at least severely curtail rebellion in the countryside. Now, to some extent, this can't be denied. I mean, if you look at some of the huge rebellions of the 17th century before the period of Louis XIV, rebellions like the Fronde, but in the countryside in the 1630s and 40s and 50s, these were enormous province-wide rebellions, usually against taxes or military conscription. This was a period of intense war, the 30 Years' War. And the fact is, when Louis XIV does begin to rule, he's determined not to let this happen again, not to let rebellion take hold again. And to some extent, he's successful. That is, if you look at the period before Louis XIV, that is in the early 17th century, and compared to the period after Louis XIV in the 18th century, these enormous province-wide or city-wide large-scale rebellions do decline. And so the story of rebellion used to be that, yeah, there was a lot of rebellion in the 17th century. Louis XIV sort of cleans everything up, builds his absolute state. We now know that it's not as absolute as he thought it was or liked to have been. And then things sort of calm down. The politics change. There's definitely a lot of conflict in the 18th century, but not this kind of popular rebellion. And then, bam, the revolution hits in 1789. So what Nicolas showed was that actually if you go out and start looking at rebellions, small rebellions, not just the gigantic rebellions, there's some continuity. There's a lot of continuity from the 17th through the 18th century in that rebellions persist, and they usually persist because of the underground economy. So instead of rebellions against the creation of a new tax, which is kind of a typical 17th century rebellion, what you have are kind of small-scale rebellions of smugglers, you know, shooting it out with or resisting arrest against farm agents. So if you include rebellions against farm agents by smugglers, then all of a sudden you have real rebellion in the 18th century. And this persists right up to 1789. And if you look at Nicolas' data, it suggests that there's, you know, there's sort of even more of these smuggling rebellions in the 1770s and 1780s. And this feeds into the revolution because one of the first major rebellions of the revolution was a rebellion by smugglers and their allies against the customs gates that were newly constructed around the city of Paris. And once you realize that that happened against this background of contraband rebellion, you realize, there's a whole other story here that feeds into the revolution. And so this is, you know, 2 days before the taking of the Bastille, there is an enormous rebellion, series of rebellions against the customs gates surrounding the city of Paris. Now, the Bastille then will happen 2 days later, mm-hmm. and kind of steals the show for historiography. But I thought it was important to highlight that how the contraband rebellion resurfaces during the French Revolution with a vengeance. And then actually from Paris, from that initial attack on the customs gates in Paris, it spreads to the provinces, especially in the north and the east, quite virulently. And there are rebellions throughout the provinces, people throwing off the farm, towns inviting smugglers into their public squares and openly selling contraband and doing it kind of joyously, doing it as part of what they see is a larger revolutionary moment and movement. And so that's one way in which the story of Mondrian and other smugglers kind of feeds in to the revolution. The other way has more to do with intellectual history and history of conceptions of the farm, perceptions of the farm by learned elites. You have a lot of learned elites, especially political economists, magistrates, legal thinkers, who are looking at this feedback system that I described earlier, this feedback system whereby farm agents and smugglers are attacking one another violently, filling up prisons, causing mayhem, creating lots of attacks and executions. And the intellectuals of the period are horrified by this. This is, for them, it's the age of enlightenment. Things are supposed to be becoming less violent. The age of religious war and violence is in the past, and they want to keep it that way and move beyond it. And yet here in their midst, in the middle of the 18th century, there's this kind of violent mayhem. And so the first people to intervene in this debate are political economists who come up with new ways of thinking about the economy. And these end up reflecting very poorly on the farm and very poorly on the calico prohibition. And I know by deflection, very poorly on the state and the way the state intervenes in society. So that there's a kind of attack on this fiscal system because of what smuggling is doing in the countryside. And so this then feeds into the revolution as well, because many of the deputies in the revolution are steeped in this literature. They are not happy with the general farm. The Cahiers de Doléances, which are petitions by ordinary people, express great hostility to the farm. And so there's a part of the early revolution is simply bent on overturning this fiscal system, overturning the criminal justice system that's associated with it, and establishing a different kind of state.
In the conclusion to the book, Michael, you turn to the question of, you know, what it might mean to consider this history of the dark side of globalization, you know, now at the beginning of the 21st century. And I imagine there are a lot of people who would want to read your book, specialists of, you know, French history, people who are interested in the history of this period, but also people who might be interested in contemporary issues and questions about globalization. What does this book teach us about how to think about, maybe complicate our thinking about contemporary questions around some of these concerns and issues?
It's a very present-oriented book.
I should say right off,
and it was meant to be. So you know, this is a second book. One has a little more leeway to kind of be playful and explore different ways of writing history. And so it was meant to sort of capture a broader audience and also play with things that are going on in our own society in the present. So one thing that struck me were some of the similarities between the underground economy of the 18th century and what we see today in our own underground economy. We know, for example, today that there is an enormous underground economy in the United States and throughout the world. All kinds of things are trafficked, including drugs, arms, counterfeit goods of all kinds, intellectual property, and human beings themselves. And so I wanted to kind of give the prehistory to this massive underground economy that's just become part of our own society at this point. The other similarity, which I hinted at earlier, was the repression. You know, we all know about the war on drugs. I was writing this, you know, every day, looking at the New York Times and seeing what the latest tally is in our in the U.S. prison system of people who are put in jail and prison for drug-related offenses. And obviously, it's quite high. I mean, we now rule the world in prison per capita prison population. And a lot of that is because of the war on drugs. This was something that was very present in my mind while I was doing research. I kind of play with that analogy in the book by calling tobacco weed sometimes, things like that. I wanted readers to kind of go back and forth between the present and the past to kind of reconsider the war on drugs in this new historical perspective. The other striking similarity was the kind of media sensation around the underground economy, right? Think about The Wire, Breaking Bad, and movies, you know, Al Pacino and Scarface. We love to watch and read and listen to songs about the underground economy. This was also true in the 18th century, especially with the execution of Montrain, where when there's that explosion of literature. So that was interesting. And then the public debate on all of this, right? I mean, we have pundits and intellectuals lamenting the repression of the war on drugs, Yet the war on drugs continues, though now it is quickly evolving. So all these things, these were analogies I wanted to draw out. At the same time, you know, thinking about this and going kind of deep into the 18th century and looking at the underground economy and then surfacing and looking at my own underground economy in 21st century United States, I did notice some really interesting discrepancies. One has to do with race. In the 18th century, race plays a prominent role on the production side of the underground economy, right? If a lot of the economy of the underground economy in the 18th century is based on tobacco, that tobacco is grown in the colonies, most of it in the colonies of Virginia and Maryland, or the states of Virginia and Maryland once the United States is born, by African slaves or slaves of African descent. It's quite extraordinary how quickly a slave society develops in Virginia around tobacco, and that tobacco is largely grown and shipped to Britain in the 18th century, and then Britain sells it to the farm. So when I say global, mm-hmm. that's what's going on for tobacco. The tobacco comes from North America, then gets shipped to Britain, then Britain to the farm. Some of it obviously doesn't reach the farm. Much of it is diverted, and that becomes the contraband tobacco that then is mixed with European homegrown tobacco. But the point is, it's mostly slave produced in the New World. Today, race is an important factor, less so, I think, in the production of these goods, though I'm sure my Latin American colleagues would have much to say mm-hmm. about race and the production of illegal drugs for U.S. consumers. I think that now race is a factor in the repression, and this is very obvious to me. We have very high incarceration rates, very high for African American men in particular. There's a really interesting book calling this a kind of new Jim Crow, this process of incarcerating African Americans for participating in this illegal drug economy. So that was striking to me, the difference of the way race worked out in both periods. And the other big difference is really the morality of the war on drugs. You know, if you go back and look at the 18th century and the monarchy is not waging a moral crusade against the tobacco itself. Or any other product that it's peddling or involved in trading. The reason why they're pushing tobacco is for purely fiscal reasons, right? To increase its revenue. And the state is not, does not have any, you know, campaigns, this is your brain on drugs type of campaign. And I found that sort of refreshing. I mean, they're simply there to make money, and they were pretty open about it, though they did have to sort of try to stigmatize smugglers to prevent them from smuggling, which obviously didn't succeed very well. On the other hand, the war on drugs that's occurred in the United States since really the 1970s, when Nixon really initiated it, is heavily moralistic. It's always been moralistic from the very start. That is, drugs are a threat. They corrupt the national moral fiber. And that's why we need to go after these things. They are inherently evil unto themselves, and we need to do all we can to expunge them from our society on these moral grounds. Obviously, the morality and the racism are tied in that respect. And so it reminded me, just to see the lack of morality in the 18th century or the lack of the moral campaign by the state, it highlighted how moralistic the U.S. campaign is in prosecuting the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. Now, all this is changing very quickly. Over the last few years, there's been an attempt to shift, you know, especially with marijuana, shift marijuana from prohibition to fiscalization, which is kind of interesting because that's sort of what the crown was doing with tobacco, trying to fiscalize this product. And this, you know, remains to be seen where this is going to go. Certainly there will continue to be underground markets, because if you fiscalize marijuana, there will be people out there who will be growing it without the taxation on it and will want to sell it for less. So there will continue to be smuggling, but the mores seem to be shifting as people suggest that not all of these drugs, illegal drugs, should be classified as illegal and prosecuted in a way that seems cruel and excessive. So this was something I could do by looking at smuggling in the 18th century. I could kind of go back and forth between the present and the past and learn something about both the present and the past. I mean, I thought that was one of the things that made this book really fun to write.
Well, and I can tell you it's one of the things that made it really interesting and fascinating to read. So I just have one last question for you, Michael, which is, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm writing a kind of synthetic work on the so-called consumer revolution. I may not call it the consumer revolution. I may call it the consumer evolution, but we shall see. But basically, it's an attempt to kind of synthesize a lot of work that's been done on the rise of consumption between, say, 1650 and 1800. But it will definitely add a more political angle than people are used to, and sort of continuing on from what I've done in my book on contraband. That is to look at the political economies of consumption, consumer politics, the role of consumption in the French Revolution, American Revolution, and elsewhere. And so to kind of get a sense of what it means to have a growth of consumption in political terms, social terms, economic terms, before the Industrial Revolution occurs.
Sounds like a great project. I just want to thank you so much, Michael, for writing this fascinating book and for talking with me about it.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me. I really enjoyed it.